This clip was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For more information about the UK Wine Show, you can go to www.ukwineshow.co.uk. Hi, I'm here with George Bowden from Leventhorpe Vineyards in Leeds. Are you part of Leeds?
I certainly am now. Yeah. I've lived here for 40-odd years, so I've got used to the place.
Excellent.
And even more so, they've got used to me.
Excellent. It's a bit strange having a vineyard this far north. You're the most furtherly
north, but not really. If you went back to the Middle Ages, in fact, the nearest large vineyard here was the Benedictine monks at St. Mary's Abbey of York. They'd a well-documented 15-acre vineyard, which actually helped with the upkeep of the monastery. But with Henry VIII's decision to seek a new wife, that went out with the dissolution of the monasteries.
How many other wineries around here, George?
I'm the only winery for about a 50-mile radius. True winery, that is. I'm sure there are other people making fruit wines and that, but it's a true winery. My next nearest neighbour is Nottingham.
Yeah.
Tony Skiriet's Eglantine down in Nottingham, which is, again, similar background to me, chemistry teacher. Decided he thought, like me, knew how to make wine, give it a try, and we're still here after 20-odd years.
So you've been here for 22
years now. 85 started, but started planting up in 86.
Okay, so you bought the land. How many acres have you got?
It's around about 6 acres.
Yeah.
Almost 2.5 hectares for common market people.
Okay. we had a look around the winery earlier, and you're growing all sorts of grapes. Do you want to just tell us what you're trying to grow up here?
Yeah, I've grown three main varieties. For the whites, the Sauvignon Blanc. I've got an acre of that, and it makes a light, very northern French-style wine, if you want to put a tag on. Very, very light Burgundy-like. Makes excellent champagne as well, mm-hmm. or champagne-style wine, I should say. And my main crop is Madeleine Angevin, which is a grape from the Loire. Ultra early in the Loire, but ripens about a month later here.
Yeah.
And endows very, very different characteristics to the wine. And overall, Pinot Gris is... Madeleine Angevin turns out very like Pinot Gris in character, and it's got that little hint of peaches, little hint of gooseberries, and little hint of blackcurrant leaf as well about it.
Yeah.
And both are excellent wines with fish, especially the Sauval, with oily fish,
yeah.
Whereas the Madeleine goes more with fish with creamy sauces, and excellent with Thai food because it's slightly spicy-ish. It goes. I sell a lot to Thai food restaurants, and believe it or not, sell quite a bit in London as well of the Madeleine to wine bars that are going over to tapas.
Oh, okay.
Because tapas has got that hint, tends to have that hint of spiciness or hotness about it, and it complements it well. So.
Is that the only two grapes, Madeleine and Sauvignon Blanc?
No, I grow many other experimental grapes as well, because you've got to keep an eye on the future.
Yeah, sure.
I've got some Riesling in.
Yeah.
Some early clones of. Chardonnay, ultra early clones of Chardonnay, and ultra early clones of Sauvignon Blanc. I've got Sauvignon Blanc as well. Now they ripen reasonably well in a good year.
Yeah.
But at the moment, I wouldn't plant them up as a commercial crop. That may be for the future. So I'm keeping an eye on global warming and ripening levels and yields. So just keep my hand in there.
Yeah.
And for the reds, I grow. A vine for Malsas called Triomphe,
yeah.
Which is an old Pinot cross.
Yeah.
And the red wine tends to be a blend of Triomphe, ultra early Pinot Noir, some Gamay,
yeah.
And two new early German varieties called Rondo and Dornfelder.
Yeah, Rondo I'm sort of reasonably familiar with. I've had some quite nice stuff.
Quite a raspberry, gives a very raspberry style, almost. Hint of Burgundy about it.
Yeah, I always think of it as sort of a texturally like a bit like a Merlot almost as well. It's nice soft round.
Soft if depending on the summer as well, depending on the soils in which it grows and the rootstock as well. But it's got great potential for Britain.
And what sort of soils are you growing here?
It's very shallow sandy loams, and in parts some of the soil's only 6 inches deep, and. 6 inches deep with about 3 foot of sand mm-hmm. under the topsoil, and then you're into sandstone rock. So it's very well drained, which is important, and a sun trap as well.
Fantastic. So the sand drains really quickly?
Very, very quickly. You can have a thunder in summer, you can have a thunderstorm lasting for 20 minutes, and half an hour after that, you can go back onto the soil with it hardly sticking to your boots. I exaggerate there a bit, but it's that kind of soil.
Is rain a bit of a problem here?
No, we're in actually a low rainfall area. Yeah. And I get about 22 inches a year here, but rather strangely, if I travel east from here, past Beverley towards Hull, it's actually the lowest rainfall area in Europe.
Okay.
You would never think so.
Yeah.
but as soon as the rain gets across there, it tends to be petering out from the west, so they just get drizzled rather than heavy rains.
During a rain shadow.
So I'm in a rain shadow from the Pennines. Okay. So it's, and that's important as well, because what you don't want is high rainfalls in summer, and of course high rainfalls in the picking season.
Yeah, for sure. All that water will get sucked up.
It'll get very sucked up, especially with light soil. If it was hanging around and the soil became desiccated and the roots became desperate, any rain that fell may be taken up quickly and dilute the flavour. But it hasn't happened here. So.
Okay, so when we had a look around the vineyard earlier, I've noticed that you've got different types of trellising and different spacings of your trellising all the way through. It seems, you know, you've got an acre of some sort of trellising with different spaces all over the place.
It's to utilise the different heat levels in the field itself. Being this far north, it's very, very marginal.
Yeah.
And everything you do
say
to
England's
help,
marginal and Leeds. Yeah.
So everything you do makes that little bit of extra help.
Yeah.
And my main growing varieties are on what's known as double Guillaume, which is an intensive way of growing with 6 foot between rows, which allows renewal of canes every year, and a large canopy, controlled canopy, but allows the heat to build up within the canopy.
Oh, okay.
And that concentrates heat onto the fruit and into the plant itself. Where at the top of the field, where it's slightly cooler, I grow them much wider. But growing them on the wide version means that there's no shading from any other plants, adjacent rows, and every leaf's in the sun at all times. And that produces a slightly different wine to the same grape grown on the double Guillaume system. It's known as a Lenz-Moser system.
Okay.
And it's half the number of vines per acre, but the same amount of cropping levels, only possible because of the large leaf area.
So even though it's quite a small vineyard you've actually almost got to tailor the vineyard to quite niche areas within
little,
it.
Little niche areas. And the Saval is my latest ripening crop, and that's in the hottest part of the vineyard. It's on the hill that gets baked in the summer, but it allows plenty of drainage of air up through the vineyard itself.
I noticed when you were talking about the grape varieties, you didn't mention Ortega, which is quite a common grape variety for vineyards, and I would have thought it'd be quite good here.
Good here, but I find that it ripens early and the birds like it.
It ripens too early.
Well, it ripens quite early,
yeah.
And where Madeleine for me is about a week later, and Madeleine's out of the wasp season, I hope, and out of the migratory bird season as well.
Oh, okay.
Where Ortega 10 days earlier can get caught with a feast for field fares, and once they pass over, they'll stop, devour everything, and then move on.
So you're not just worrying about the weather, you've actually got to pick it between the wildlife as well.
Because there's nothing much you can do about birds except net.
Yeah.
And once you net up, which is quite expensive, you've got problems with badgers then tearing the nets down, and you've got problem with getting birds trapped in and dying from want of drink and that, and hedgehogs getting entangled. So netting's not always an option. It's better to have the grapes ripening at a later time out of the problem season. So the other aspect of a vineyard like this far north, is frost.
Yep, frost.
If you've got frost every year and the new growth at the end of April gets frosted, you waste your time.
Yeah.
Pick the vineyard because between the third week in April and almost the end of November, I don't tend to get frosts.
Mm-hmm.
There's frosts around,
yeah.
But the actual topography of the vineyard ensures temperature inversion, where the cold air, instead of dropping down to bud level, remains around about 6 foot, with a layer of warm air trapped beneath the cold air.
Yeah, that seems quite strange. I know people talk about temperature inversion all over the place.
And it's very, very important. Without that temperature inversion, I don't think I'll be able to crop here commercially, because I rather feel that out of 10 vintages, I'd probably get 5 or 6 reliable vintages due to frost, and I would make the vineyard uncommercial.
You were saying earlier that the site... It's always been considered an early cropping site.
Always, yeah.
Yeah.
The actual land, little field itself, has been enclosed since Anglo-Saxon times. It's even in the Domesday Book. It's called Hill Field. And it was recognised as a warm little area. And it's the kind of field where, from Middle Ages up to First World War, farmers used to overwinter their pigs in the field, where the pigs could lie in the sun when the sun was out in the winter and warm themselves. They feel the cold just as much as we do.
Yeah.
And farmers also brought the bees here as well. Pigs that grub around the winter, get rid of all the roots and weeds, fertilise the field, so the farmer will then just have to harrow and plant up for the summer season, spring and summer season. And that was the routine going way back to, presume, early Middle Ages.
Yeah.
And... between the wars, between the First World War and the Second World War, the actual field was a rose nursery. And anybody growing roses needs soil that's spot on to show off the roses at, yep. As being first class. And well-drained, sandy soil is excellent for that.
Okay.
And since the war, it's been an arable field. And all things being equal, this was always the field that got harvested first, sometimes up to a fortnight earlier than adjacent fields, with the same crop.
So it's almost like a microclimate in the area.
It's a good mesoclimate for field itself, and you build up that mesoclimate for the vines itself into a very good microclimate.
Mm.
As much heat around the vines as possible, and as much exposure to the sun as possible as well.
On the way here, we saw lots and lots of tourist signs for all sorts of things, but hardly any tourist signs, in fact, no tourist signs for your vineyard, and yet I see that you've Rick Stein wrote you up and recommended you in his book.
People know where I am. If they want to find me, they find me.
Yeah.
So it's I put it that way. Start going down the tourist route, enter a different ballgame.
Yeah.
Then it's passing trade.
Yeah, okay.
My business is built on loyal customers, and... very slow, and very slow build-up to that over the years. But nevertheless, when you get into that system, you've always got the custom coming in and the loyalty coming in.
You said you sell a lot of wine into London. How do the people in Yorkshire take your wine? Do you sell it to them, or is it?
Of course I do. Those people who know about me, obviously, come down, and quite a few other people are incredulous. There's obviously a prejudice against growing wine, because wine in England's always seen as an exotic drink.
Yeah.
In the same way that American wine in America was seen, or at least wine in America was seen as an exotic drink. When the Americans started to produce themselves on a serious scale, they had, in the 60s, difficulty in getting accepted. But look where they are now. They've overcome their problems, and anybody who grows vines has to overcome some problem of some sort, whether it's in the south of France where it's starting to get too hot, or in this part of the world where I'm chasing the heat. Nevertheless, we've still got problems for different reasons.
I'm from Otago. I remember when they planted up in Otago for the first time as a wee kid, and all my family just thought they're absolutely bonkers. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and look at Otago Pinot Noir now, best in the world.
After Leventhal.
Excellent, excellent.
So it's horses for courses. You look for the site, and you don't just plant up in any old site.
Mm-hmm.
For example, if it was just an area that grew good wine, you could argue why isn't the world absolutely awash with fantastic Burgundy? It's not.
Yeah.
There's only so many sites in Burgundy that would grow fantastic wine.
What do you think is your biggest problem growing grapes up in Leeds?
I presume the climate.
The climate, yeah.
But that's where you overcome the climate with your site and management of the vineyard, the types of vines you plant, and not only the types of variety of vines, but the actual clones.
Yeah,
there are different clones that have different characteristics.
Clones are where you've got the same grape variety.
Same grape, but they're either earlier ripening, later ripening, heavier crop, lighter crop. and
different genetics
and slightly different genetics that can stand up to cooler conditions, and that's what you've got to pick. Nothing to do with the genetic modification, whatever. It's just that over the years these have been picked and selected to go with the climate and do best with that particular climate.
You were a chemistry teacher, weren't you, George?
That's right. Yeah.
Do you think that's helped a bit?
I think so. I used to use winemaking. It's fantastic for getting across science, aspects of science. And I used to run little modules of winemaking. Not winemaking itself, but using the scientific methods that go into winemaking to get across scientific techniques. And it always worked. So.
Okay.
Because there's always a little bit of wine at the end of it.
Yeah. All right, George, I think we'll wrap it up there.
The thing is, it is possible with global warming, Britain could actually become the Burgundy of the future, because with the southern French temperatures creeping up into Burgundy, Burgundy's moving to Champagne. Champagne's moving to England.
Yeah.
So to speak, because two of the top 10 sparkling wines in the world are English, Knight Timber and Ridgeview.
Yeah.
And they are setting the benchmark. I think Britain in the future will get its reputation on excellent sparkling wines,
mm-hmm.
with very good, unusual, other grape wines to come in the future.
Richard Seeley, a geologist, said that our grandchildren will be drinking Sheffield Shiraz. Do you think that's true?
Quite possibly, but we may not be around to see that. We're looking very much into the future.
All right then, mate. Cheers very much.
Cheers. Thanks for that.